For What's Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Turkey's armed forces and rebel allies have pushed deeper into Syria. On the fifth day in offensive, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan insists is aimed at both U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters and militants of Islamic State. Turkey sent its military into Syria Wednesday, seizing the border town of Yarablus from IS militants.
Daesh'in Suriye ve Irak'tan temizlenmesi için.
At a rally Sunday, Mr. Erdogan vowed to give every support to cleanse Islamic State from Syria and Iraq. That's why he added, we're in Yarablus and Bashika. Regional analyst Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales was asked if this is in response to suicide bombings by IS and Kurdish separatists in Turkey.
Yes, it is to an extent a response to that, but perhaps more important, an attempt to prevent the Kurds in Syria from forming a solid geographic bloc, because up until now, they've been scattered all over the northern part of Syria without any real geographic contiguity.
Turkish officials say their goal in Syria is to ensure Kurdish forces don't expand the territory they control along Turkey's border while driving IS militants from their strongholds. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari Sunday said the leader of Boko Haram, Abubakar Shekau, was wounded in a recent airstrike. Speaking on the sidelines of a development conference in Kenya, Mr. Buhari said Boko Haram no longer holds any Nigerian territory, and the insurgency has split into smaller groups attacking soft targets. The Nigerian leader said he's prepared to talk with bona fide leaders of Boko Haram about the release of more than 200 schoolgirls still missing after being abducted by the group in Chibok, Borno State, more than 2 years ago. This is VOA News. The commander of Colombia's FARC insurgency Sunday said his fighters will end all hostilities early Monday, following a peace agreement to be signed next month, ending more than half a century of fighting. President Emeritus and senior fellow of the Washington-based Inter-American Dialogue, Peter Hakim, called the announcement significant.
One can dispute and disagree about the precise terms of the agreement, but the fact that both sides are ready to sign an agreement means that both sides believe whatever they want to accomplish can be best accomplished through peace, not war.
Earlier, Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos announced the military would end operations against rebels Monday, the deal expected to be put to a referendum in October. In central Italy, the search for more bodies from last week's earthquake continues as officials open an investigation into negligence played a part in the devastation caused by Wednesday's 6.2 magnitude quake. Nearly 300 are known to have died. Hundreds more were injured. Several are still unaccounted for. The warring sides in Yemen's conflict are indicating a willingness to restart peace talks aimed at ending 18 months of fighting. UN-sponsored talks collapsed in Kuwait earlier this month between the Houthi rebels and representatives of the internationally recognized government of President Abrabu Mansour Hadi. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta agreed to further trade and investment between the two countries at the end of a conference in Nairobi.
We signed an important document, which is the promotion and protection of investments, which we expect will spur Japanese private sector investments in Kenya.
Mr. Abe said Tokyo is prepared to commit $30 billion in public and private support for infrastructure development, education, and healthcare programs. Germany's economy minister, Sigmar Gabriel, Sunday said negotiations on a massive free trade agreement between the European Union and the United States is effectively dead. Gabriel said after 14 rounds of negotiations, the two sides haven't reached any agreement. He accused Washington of being angry over EU negotiations with Canada on a rival free trade deal. Most Asian stock markets fell in Monday trading, but Japanese stocks soared on a weaker yen following last week's comments by the chairperson of the U.S. Central Bank, who hinted at an interest rate hike by year's end. Janet Yellen Friday said a pickup in U.S. economic activity and improving job market means the case for a federal funds rate hike has strengthened. U.S. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump is expected to deliver a major speech on illegal immigration Wednesday in Arizona. The issue has been central to his campaign for the White House, promising greater border security. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Mpate in Washington. Today is Monday, August 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Both candidates in Saturday's Gabon presidential election are claiming victory.
Yesterday, the day after the election, the first thing is the opponent jumping, call his militants in the house and tell them he's a winner.
That's VOA French to Africa reporter Idriss Fall in Libreville. The opposition accuses Ghanaian President John Mahama of favoritism in pardoning three men jailed for making death threats against Supreme Court judges. A new report says gender inequality hampers African human development and economic growth, and the Liberian Senate offers to mediate an impasse in the House of Representatives.
Constitutionally, the two houses are independent of each other. But as a sister whose house is on fire, we have taken the initiative upon ourselves to help the House of Representatives to get reorganized.
Senator Amajala is the Senate pro tempore of the Liberian Senate. Sierra Leone lacks medical facilities to treat kidney disease, and South Sudan refugees are afraid to leave their homes for medical health. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Official results in Saturday's Gabon presidential election are not expected until tomorrow, Tuesday, but supporters of President Ali Bongo and his chief rival, Jean Ping, are both claiming victory. Challenger and 73-year-old Ping, a former foreign minister and African Union Commission chairman, claimed Sunday that general trends indicate that he had won. But a spokesman for Mr. Bongo said the president is headed to re-election for a second term. Joining us now from Libreville is Idriss Fall of VOA's French to Africa service. Good morning, Idriss.
Good morning, James Bati. Good morning to all the listeners of VOA.
It's so nice to have you on Daybreak Africa. You are in Libreville. What can you tell us what's happening there after the very important presidential election?
Yesterday, the day after the election, the first thing is the opponent jumping, call his militants in the house and tell them he's a winner. Presents himself as the president who's going to unify Gabon. Few hours later and a few blocks away from where he was doing his rassemblement or meeting with his militants, the president, Ali Bongo, also in a place called the Jardin Botanique, called his militant and said that himself, he is very confident and say thanks to those who voted for him. He said that he was waiting also for the result. We expect having the first result today, Monday, and the interior minister said that he's going to announce the first result by Tuesday, meaning tomorrow.
The ordinary people in Gabon, how are they taking it? I guess they must be confused now.
Not confused. They are kind of scared. You know, the country is a little bit very, very divided. But the normal people, some of them went inside the country because they expect that you may have some violence.
Idriss, we know that President Bongo has been in power for some time now, and Mr. Jean Ping, a former African Union official, what is his popularity with the ordinary Gabonese?
Well, it's difficult to say because Jean Ping, people tend to forget, he had been minister for the dad, Omar Bongo, for years and years, minister of oil and whatever it may be, before becoming the president of the African Union Commission. On the other hand, Mr. Ali Bongo came to power after the death of the dad. And when he was elected in 2009, everybody remember there were a lot of violence, especially in Port-Gentil, where still now we don't know how many people were killed. Some say hundreds, others say thousands. So you have the campaign itself. Really, it was kind of people accusations, insults. But it was not a real debate about a program or on each of them what he want to do about the future of his country.
I know that President Bongo said that he's waiting for results from the National Elections Commission. You know, all over Africa, the argument is that the Elections Commission is always tied to the government in power. How independent do you think the Elections Commission is?
Well, how independent is the Senate? I don't know. I know that they are formed, and the opposition has its representative there. And during the election on Saturday, opposition was represented in every polling station. Now they're gathering all the results, and we're going to see what they're going to say. But I cannot judge myself to say it is an independent body or not independent body. I really don't know.
Idrissa, thank you.
Thank you, and have a good day.
That's reporter Idriss Fall of VOA's French to Africa service speaking with us from Libreville, Gabon. The president pro tempore of the Liberian Senate says his body has set up a peace committee to try resolve the stalemate in the House of Representatives. The House has been paralyzed for more than 2 months now due to disagreement between two groups of lawmakers. One group wants the Speaker of the House, Alex Tyler, to recuse himself from presiding over the official business of the House until he is clear of alleged corruption charges. The Speaker and those who support him said he's innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Pro tempore Amajala says the Senate is concerned that the quagmire in the House has stalled the business of the legislature. He said the peace committee will soon present a proposal to the opposing sides on how best to resolve the standoff.
Constitutionally, the two houses are independent of each other. But as a sister whose house is on fire, we have taken the initiative upon ourselves to help the House of Representatives to get reorganized. So a peace committee has been established. This committee is working with both sides to see how we can bring them together to reason to be able to work together to do the Liberian people business. We have a peace proposal that we are refining right now. That process should be concluded in the next few days. And our proposal will be presented to both sides. And subsequently, we should be able to meet with them to be able to reason out on how we can bring an end to this stalemate.
I am told, therefore, Mr. Pro Temp, that in the process, you have said that the Senate will not do business with both sides in the House of Representatives. Is that true?
When we are mediating, we're supposed to be neutral. That's one. The Speaker is the legitimate Speaker, but the number isn't on the Speaker's side to be able to take decisions. The other groups, they may have the number, but they don't also have a constitutional presiding officer to be able to preside over that body. So considering the three factors, we intend to remain neutral and play a mediating role to find an end to this conflict.
Talk to the ordinary Liberian who might be concerned in terms of the business of the country while the impasse continues in the legislature. What would you say to the ordinary Liberian?
We are cognizant of the fact that there is a crisis. That crisis has stalled work in the government, especially at the side of the legislature. And we are taking steps now as one of the houses in the legislature to help the sister house to get reorganized.
Who can come in and say, no, you are the national legislature, you cannot behave this way? Who can do that legally? Is it the president or the Supreme Court of Liberia?
I hope the Supreme Court could do that because she has the authority to review constitutional actions to see whether or not they are legal.
I asked the question about the business of the country because there are some people who are saying, well, there's election coming up next year. There's some business. For example, should Liberia have a national referendum before the election, deciding on the recommendations of the Constitutional Review Commission? Those are things that the legislature should be talking about.
Yeah, until the conflict is resolved, we'll not be able to make progress on those legislation you have mentioned, some of them. So for us, it's a priority right now to ensure that the conflict is resolved and we get back to doing the Liberian people business.
How soon before you think there will be some answer or some resolution?
We are intervening. We have made the initial contacts, working on the peace plan that we are going to submit. We are hoping that both parties will be able to listen to us to sort out a solution that would be in the interest of the country.
Would this include the Speaker recusing himself, or because that's the sticking point right now?
Our proposal is comprehensive. Let me leave the specifics of what are in the proposal.
Amajala is a president pro tempore of the Liberian Senate. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Today is Monday, August 29th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. In Ghana, President John Mahama has pardoned three men who had been jailed for 4 months after making death threats against Supreme Court judges. The opposition says the three are ruling party activists. During a panel discussion on local radio, the men have said they will, quote, finish judges who ruled in favor of the opposition in cases concerning electoral reforms. But a former attorney general and minister of justice, Atukwe Atu, says the pardon may backfire against the president. He tells reporter Kofi Aboche that the president's pardon may cause a constitutional crisis.
In Ghana, Article 126 plus 2 provides as follows. The superior courts shall be superior courts of record and shall have the power to commit for contempt to themselves and all such powers as are vested in a court of record immediately before the coming to force of this constitution. So there is a constitutional basis for committal for contempt, which is Article 126 plus 2 of the constitution. And mind you, the words used are the superior courts of record. So the power is there to commit for contempt, and I owe the view that the Supreme Court can exercise that power. Elsewhere, it is argued that the Attorney General should be in the forefront. But it's clear that contempt is a specialized kind of crime. So, Kumaba, we are all aware that in Ghana we don't have it. It's power which is inherent in the court itself. So, who determines the penalty? Who can tell me that indeed it should be 4 months, it should be 3 months, it should be 1 month, it should be 3 days? And the penalty is not so prescribed.
So the judges would have punished them more than they did.
It is clearly in their bosom to determine what, in their view, first of all, constitutes contempt of court, and secondly, the appropriate punishment that should go with it.
So what is appropriate in this case? Now that the Constitution did not define how to punish them, what is appropriate now?
It is left to them to decide. It is entirely in their discretion to decide what they think should be appropriate. Now, mind you, I have said that what the president has done amounts to saying that the Supreme Court judges are not reasonable.
Oh, but the same Constitution grants the president that prerogative.
That's where I'm coming to. During the election petition, various cases of contempt arose. So when they decide that for this particular offense, they want you to go in for 4 months, then they know exactly what they are saying. And if you read the ruling, they said that they wanted to send out a signal there that this thing should be stopped.
Yeah. To the lay mind, these people never committed any offense. In other words, they carried a threat, but they did not. I mean, they came with a threat but never carried any action out.
Why should they carry the threat in the first place? The offense is committed when you threaten somebody. So threatening with harm or threatening with death is the offense by itself. It is not only that, but the language they use in describing the judgment. Remember that this had to do with the Abu Ramadan case, and the position of the law regarding judgments is that you can criticize a judgment, but you should use temperate language. And you don't threaten them that we know your houses, that we would marry the Chief Justice, that we would deal with you if you have forgotten what happened on 30th June. I mean, 30th June, there was people, judges were kidnapped from, adopted from their homes and killed. So that was a threat, a direct threat of death and harm. And that is a use of intemperate language, which amounts to scandalizing the court.
That was former Ghanaian Attorney General and Minister of Justice, Atukwe Atu, speaking to reporter Kofi Aboche in Accra. People are dying in Sierra Leone of kidney disease due to the lack of available treatment. Patients have to fly to other countries, and many cannot afford it. As Nina DeVries reports from Freetown, the country's only dialysis unit is not operational.
Frederick Garber is just 15 years old and is suffering from a kidney infection. He's currently on medication to try and control it, but is often in pain. He needs a kidney biopsy to diagnose exactly what the problem is, and also may need dialysis treatment, neither of which can be done in Sierra Leone. It's a tough situation for his father, Joseph.
It's very frustrating because, you know, for me to get at least the treatment for him, the treatment is not doing here. So I have to, you know, to find ways and means to take the boy out of this country. And for me, I don't think, you know, I'm financially strong.
Since 2012, a dialysis unit has been at the Conant Hospital in Freetown. The Israeli government donated it. but it needs a water treatment plant installed to properly function, according to Niyama Kamara. She is a dialysis consultant working with the Ministry of Health and Sanitation of Sierra Leone. No one else is qualified to install it in the country, and so everything is on hold until a technician can come from Israel. One was supposed to come, but when the Ebola crisis hit Sierra Leone, the trip was cancelled, says Kamara.
And we have a lot of cases coming at Connaught Hospital that needs dialysis. But what do? The machines are here and people are dying and we need the machines to work. You know, this is the only unit.
There is no specific data on how many people have died in Sierra Leone from kidney disease, but according to the National Kidney Foundation, 10% of the world's population is affected by chronic kidney disease, and millions die each year because they cannot access affordable treatment. Non-communicable diseases, such as kidney disease, have replaced communicable diseases, such as malaria, as the most common causes of premature death worldwide. Dr. Soka Kabia is Sierra Leone's only nephrologist. He says the fact that there is not even a lab to do biopsies like Frederick Garber's is a huge problem, and kidney disease can be managed with the right facilities.
I know it is something that often is preventable and also sometimes reversible, at times not, many times not, but you can slow down the progression.
Meanwhile, Joseph Garber has started a fundraising campaign for his son, which he hopes will help.
It's really painful. For as a father, for you to be seeing your child in pain, you know, and you have no option but to just console him, is really painful.
It's not clear when the dialysis unit will be fully operating. Nina DeVries, VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
As thousands of South Sudanese refugees continue to pour into neighboring countries due to insecurity, aid agencies, including the French medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, say people who are fleeing often leave behind the only source of medical care available to them. IMBO of VOA South Sudan in Focus program has more from Washington.
MSF says many people are too afraid to leave their homes to look for medical help because they fear attacks by government or opposition soldiers. Ton Berg, head of the South Sudan-based MSF Holland Mission, says compounding the problem is the fact that many humanitarian organizations have recently evacuated their staff from South Sudan due to the ongoing fighting.
So many people have again been displaced, and it will be very difficult for them to travel to go to the clinics that are still open. So our concern is really that there was not already such a perfect health system in place in South Sudan, that now even less people have access to the care that they need.
The World Health Organization, or WHO, says the doctor-to-patient ratio in South Sudan is one physician per 65,000 people, while the ratio of midwives is one per a population of 39,000. To make matters worse, WHO also reports there's an unbalanced distribution of health workers across the states, with Central Equatoria having the highest number of health workers before last month's fighting broke out. Berg says the insecurity triggered by the violence in Juba affected the entire country, leaving little to no assistance in the most conflict-affected areas in Lare and Unity State, and some parts of Wau. He says the decline in access to health care prompted his team to expand their reach with mobile clinics.
And we're still not treating less people because we've also been stepping up our activities. Like over the last month, we have been working in Juba, something we didn't do before. But since the clashes, we also started working in Juba itself. So that also makes quite a difference. I think we've treated 20,000 people in our mobile clinics.
Berg says MSF continues to treat about 60,000 people a month in South Sudan. While aid agencies have made progress in containing cholera, Berg says another disease they're keeping an eye on is malaria, especially with the onset of the rainy season. Over 3,000 cases of malaria have been reported in Wau and Western Bahr al-Ghazal since June. Berg says the large number of refugees and displaced people does not help matters.
That's an enormous number of people that have fled for the violence, and there's still violence going on in Equatoria. So there's still people that cannot move freely and therefore don't have easy access to health care.
Two MSF clinics were destroyed in the greater Upper Nile region at the end of July. The violence there forced the local populations to flee, which meant residents left behind their only access to medical staff and humanitarian assistance. Berg says MSF continues to urge government and opposition soldiers to allow aid workers free and unfettered access to help people in need, something he says is not happening in several parts of the country. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
A new report finds that economic and social discrimination against women is costing Africa more than $100 billion a year. The UN Development Programme's 2016 Africa Human Development Report argues that closing the gender gap will be a benefit to the continent's economic and social prospects. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The report finds African women across the board are denied the same kind of economic, social, and political opportunities men enjoy. It says women lose out when it comes to education, work, and health. It notes fewer girls than boys go to school. Women earn less money than men for paid labor. Harmful traditional practices affect their health, and certain cultural norms act as a hindrance to women moving ahead in society. The report finds practices such as child marriage and sexual and physical violence adversely affect women's health and result in high maternal mortality. Ayodele Odusola is UN Development Program Chief Economist for the Regional Bureau for Africa. On a line from Nairobi, Kenya, he tells VOA evidence shows countries that invest heavily on gender equality tend to perform better on human development.
On the basis of this, investing in gender equality and women empowerment is not only a human rights issue, but it's a good economic and at the same time, a development imperative. What we learned is that if we are able to address the impediments in the labor market, for instance, it's going to enhance not only socioeconomic opportunities of women, but it's going to enhance the growth opportunity for African countries.
The report notes sub-Saharan Africa pays a very high price for maintaining discriminatory gender policies. It estimates total economic losses due to gender inequality in the labor market in 2014 cost the region $105 billion, or 6% of its gross domestic product. UN economists point to Rwanda as one of a few African countries that has increased the level of its human development index, that is, its life expectancy, education, and per capita income, by bridging the gender divide. Ayodele Odusola says some things are beginning to change for the better elsewhere in Africa. He says reproductive rights are becoming acceptable in Niger and Burkina Faso, countries where talk of family planning used to be taboo. He says Gambia is one of several countries that have banned early child marriage. The report proposes several strategies for creating greater gender equality. It calls on African countries to adopt legal reforms to give women a greater voice in decision-making, to actively promote gender equality and women's empowerment, and to ensure women have ownership of assets and management of resources. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Supporters of Gabon President Ali Bongo and his chief rival Jean Ping are both claiming victory and alleging fraud in the Central African nation's presidential election. The official results in the oil-rich nation's Saturday election won't be known until Tuesday. And that's it for this Monday, August 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clarty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that you will make this week a very productive one.
Tuesday on Health Chat, in light of the World Water Week, host Lenore Moudou will discuss some waterborne diseases like cholera. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Else chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.